You're listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, you're listening to Invisible, The Stranger's Conversation Weekly with People in Art. I'm on the line with Harry Dodge and Stania Khan. Hi.
Hi.
We're on a conference call that was relatively complicated to set up, but we've done it. And you guys are coming up to Portland next week. By the time this podcast comes out, it'll be pretty much right then. What are you coming up here? You're showing something called Masters of None?
Yes. We're showing a video called Masters of None, and then also when we give our talk, we'll probably show some of our other videos.
Okay. What is Masters of
None? Talk at a thing called the Back Room. And,
at the Back Room?
Yeah, it's called the Back Room, if anyone from Portland's listening, or if anyone's going to be at the TBA Festival. It's sort of like a dinner and then a conversation. So we'll be able to show some videos.
That's on Friday.
On Friday.
Yeah.
September,
yeah, so like we'll
Friday,
September 12th.
Oh, okay. Friday, September 12th.
Friday, September 12th. Yeah. Yeah. So we'll like show a few videos and they're generally pretty funny, and then afterwards we talk and we like to hear from the audience, get questions, and we'll just kind of riff on what the room seems interested in talking about.
Let's talk a little bit about what you guys have done and then this new work. So is Masters of None new? I haven't heard about it.
No, Masters of None.
It's a couple years old now, right, Sonia?
A couple years old. Yeah, it's a couple years
How
old.
How many?
Couple.
Couple, okay.
Yeah, couple.
Where
has
it been shown? No.
It's
maybe a
really,
year. You know what? Because that premiered at the Hammer last summer. So that probably
really?
counts as its inception date.
It's a show called Stephen's Edge at the Hammer Museum. It was finished in 2006, and it showed in Miami, but really had its main debut at the Hammer Museum.
Oh,
and Masters of None was a real sort of divergent piece for us. We, up until that point, we had been making a lot of dialogue-based work where, you know, it was very text-heavy in a great way, and it was mainly most of the pieces, except for one called Whacker, where Stania is just weed-whacking for 7 minutes. Most of them, she was talking pretty much wall-to-wall. And then Masters of None was totally a departure, where we had put orange hoods over the all the human people in the movie, and there was no language at all, really. No language at all. So it was a real experiment for us, a real departure, very image-based.
And also, because also at Eden's Edge was Can't Swallow It, Can't Spit It Out, right?
Right, yep.
Correct.
And that is much more typical of that path work that you're talking about, where it's text.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the, Stania was wearing a Viking helmet and holding cheese, and
right.
Harry, you were behind the camera.
She had a dried, bloody nose
bloody
the whole
nose,
time,
yeah.
too.
And you guys are walking around the streets of L.A. at night.
Yeah, so and that piece, exactly, that piece is 25 minutes edited, and even though we shot, what do we shoot, Sonia, 10 to 1 on that?
20 to 1.
20 to 1. We shot 20 to 1 on that. So to get it like a half an hour, basically, piece out of that, we had managed somehow to shoot 20 hours of video. Is that true?
Well, the ratio is 20 to 1.
Excuse me, yes, 10 hours of video.
The ratio is 20 to 1, so 10 hours of video to half an hour, which is actually typical for most of the pieces. Like,
really?
We shoot and we shoot and we shoot, and part of the reason for that is because there's an improvisational element, both not only by, you know, whoever's performing, but also by whoever's shooting. And the process is very much about discovering what the particular location brings to the conversation, discovering what kind of whatever's going on around us in the environment, whatever we're thinking
about.
And
what
about
our moods might bring, the kinds of things
we
were going to get that day.
Yeah.
So it's very much about finding
the
moment.
Yeah, and
you
then
guys,
yeah.
You guys warned me that you would be talking over each other.
Yeah, we did. We warned you.
Yeah. you know, has your work changed since you have broken up? Because you haven't broken up as artists, but you've broken up as a couple.
Our personal relationship didn't really have much to do with the artwork, so.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
so it doesn't really affect the work.
I don't necessarily. No, I mean, except for in the way that everything affects everything.
Right.
Like,
not to get cosmological on you or anything.
You know what I mean? Like,
kind of a butterfly effect kind of thing. You know, you just can't really track it. You know.
Well, you met in 93, right?
Approximately. Yeah, 92, 93. Yeah, that sounds right.
In San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And was Wacker your first video together? Or Winner?
Winner was.
Winner. I always get those.
Before Winner, we had collaborated on live performances, but our first video really was this movie called By Hook or By Crook. And none of us had ever picked up a camera in our lives or shot anything. And Harry and Silas worked for years writing this script for this feature film. And they invited me to participate on that with them, and that was our first collaborative experience in the moving image.
When was that?
That was 98.
That was a 5-year project that ended in, I think, 1999 or 2000. We eventually made a feature film.
It had its official premiere in 2000.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So that was a 5-year project, but it's called By Hook or By Crook. Anyone can rent it from Netflix. Blockbuster.
You can Netflix it?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Really?
That's a regular movie. If anyone's going to go out and watch that, they should be forewarned that it really, I don't even think of it as continuous as with, you know, continuous with the more sort of, I guess I think of it as a fine arts pursuit with this video making. It feels like that the feature film was seeking to, there was a conventional, there was something conventional that we were trying to attain.
Because there was a pressure on when you've gotten in that far in feature filmmaking, as in labor, time, and money, there becomes a pressure to sell the thing as soon as you get to anywhere significant like Sundance or whatever. And so while the whole process was happening, there's this conversation sitting on your head like a huge wet rubber tire that's going, yeah, but will it sell? Will it sell?
Yeah, does this make sense in a conventional way? Anyway.
Yeah, and will it sell in relationship to a mainstream, you know, and you can say independent filmmaking, but come on, the line is really thin between independent cinema and mainstream cinema. And for us, we were pretty eager to step right back out of that river as soon as we were able to, not because it wasn't rewarding and incredible and we learned so much, and it's not like we're entirely embarrassed of the film. It was an amazing process, but much more freeing to continue more along the lines of what we were doing before that, which was making our own work on our own terms. And in the art world, of course, there's still, you know, a pressure to sell, but on a really different set of terms that are not really defined in any means by the same thing as what mainstream.
Right. The conventions, such as they are, and they do exist in the art world, the conventions of art making are so varied, you know. And I thought after that 5-year project doing By Hook or By Crook, I thought, well, I could spend, you know, 5 years making a piece of art, trying to make it, like, for the market and never sell it and have basically wasted 5 years, you know, if that's your goal. I just really wanted to be able to go out into my garage and make, like, whatever I wanted to make, whatever weird thing I wanted to make. And it's not that you're assured of making a living in art. But you don't want to compromise on a daily basis.
Yeah, and so as soon as that was over, we both, you know, that's when we said, grab the camera, no crew, no budget, no tech, just the two of us, and run out and make
the park
work quick.
And that's when you made Winner?
That's when we made Winner, and we made it very quickly. It was entirely improvised, and it was really fun, and it was super cheery, and we were cracking up when we watched the footage, and there was something we found where both of our interests really met up, and we found a new way for working. And then, of course, each video we made after that did have its own process. There's not a formulaic approach to making each piece, which has been also fun because then we've discovered different things with each set of circumstances, which is partly why it's hard to answer the question like, well, what's changed? We're like, well, everything's always changing.
Right.
Exactly.
But so Winner was really our first sort of official art video collaboration.
One thing
a lot
I
of
think
people,
is, oh, go
sorry,
ahead.
Go ahead.
No, Harry, go
I was just going to, and just to add that a lot of people tend to divide, well, not a lot of people, but every once in a while you get an interviewer or somebody who thinks that there's some sort of like director-performer imperative that we're following, and it's really not like that. We both really do, we do everything. We both conceive of themes.
Yeah.
We have long discussions about the kinds of interests and thematics and forms. Very formal
and
things
shot,
that are
and even dots and like you know how a thing will look or sound and
right.
It's the world
well,
that, that's another.
I was actually going to ask about that because because Can't Swallow It, Can't Spit It Out has that behind the camera character and the in front of the camera character, but there's not a sense of like who's in control. There's definitely not that sort of okay, you know what she's going to do and she knows what you're going to do. You know,
yeah,
you don't know, like
constantly evolving. Thing that's what's so hard even in an art context especially when it comes to time-based work or more particularly moving images like movies, this film, video, there's this really unshakable desire that people really want to know who did what and they want to assume the language of traditional cinematic divisions of labor, and we're in a constant looping resistance with that where we have to go, if you can imagine something more fluid, please do, because you can't sort of pin this down in such a way. And I'm not sure why there's such an interest in doing that, except for that everything in our entire society places a pressure on everything to be named, categorized, indexed, and then divided into a hierarchy. So
yeah.
Our process
resists that as
much as our philosophy does. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I mean, I was really, you guys are, kind of unclassifiable in that way. Like, there's no, it's not quite performance, but it's definitely not performance. It feels like performance.
Right.
And
yeah.
I've heard you talk about vaudeville, it is actually really hysterically funny, but also like kind of upsetting. And
good. That sounds perfect.
And thank you.
No, thank you.
And oh no. And so I just there's that kind of that flow idea is actually really coming through in terms of. Giving the viewer, I mean, the viewer has no idea what's going to happen, but also the sense that neither one of you knows quite what's going to happen.
Can I just answer to that?
Oh, yes. I'll be quiet.
Sure. Yeah. I wanted just to say that I think that one of the things that happened when Sonny and I started working together was just that we did actually have a lot in common with a longstanding interest, both in stand-up comedy, vaudeville, and also this kind of pathos woven into these things. There's all kinds of people we both loved, and they're the kind of comedians like Richard Pryor, Andy Kaufman, on and on and on, Lily Tomlin, everybody, who can sit there and make you laugh and cry and just be there with them. And I think we both knew and were in a practice of knowing that kind of power, when you see it, and we were both enthralled by it in other performers, and somehow beholden to it in a way, or aspiring to it. I feel like that it happens because that performer is arriving in the moment and they somehow are peeled off enough, and everyone, all the art making that's going on in that moment is peeled enough or vulnerable enough to be able to dare to arrive in the present. And I think that what you're talking about where you don't know what's going to happen, I think that exact thing is sort of exactly what we're after. Even it's harder to do, obviously, when you're on stage, you're always responding to the moment. You know, whether you're on a script or not, as a performer, you have an audience in front of you and you can feel them and they can feel you. And I feel like we're always trying to, like, make that happen on video, if you would, or if we could.
Well,
to have that magic, still retain that magic of the moment and that vulnerability.
Yeah, I would just, and I totally agree and would add that I think that, again, another place where sometimes it's hard to find the language to really explain this is when we say, yes, we work improvisationally, there are times when we don't have a storyboard, a script, or a set determined end point, and so then it seems like, quote unquote, we don't know what's going to happen or what we're doing. Just to say that's really different than we don't know what we're doing, because because I recently was in this interview, you know, and you know, okay, let me not go there, but let's just say that there's a lay understanding of improvisation to mean just like you don't know what you're doing in, or you're going to just make it up on the spot. And that there's really, improvisation is like an iceberg. It's this deep, deep, huge thing where underneath what's happening in the moment is a lot of practice in being in the moment, and a lot of practice
finding
the moment. And so in terms of like crafting a piece that, and this is not to like try to sound really self-important, but just to actually say we sweat over it and it's not as easy as it sounds, and that it's a kind of a vigorous and exuberant process for us, which is why I think we go back to it again and again and again, which is that what it means is we have to be in the creative process proportionately a lot more of the time than, let's say, something that's been pre-scripted, then you have to just go and shoot it. Or even the map for editing. I mean, there's a lot
editing of... Editing is very generative.
The editing is such a huge part of it, you know what I mean?
It's enormous.
It's like really maybe the biggest part, and that's where a bunch of story making happens. And moving pieces around and moving parts around. So I guess I'm starting to ramble, but I wanted to just kind of say that it's not just this loosey-goosey, hey, we got lucky because, you know, we were jaunty and charismatic on any given day. It's really like a whole body of, like, years of practice. I mean, I started practicing improvisation, like, almost 20 years ago. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a long old business anyway, so that it takes
a certain... We both met each other as performers, live performers, then we did that huge video project, and I think that we both brought a lot of skills to something that looks a little bit just like you're pointing a video camera, you know, around, you know.
Yeah, and so...
it's sort of not there.
Yeah.
But there's an informality to the finish, I think, that lends itself to thinking that it was an informal process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. So there's an informality, and like people love to go, oh, yeah, those guys are so low-tech and blah, blah, blah. And I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, you know, it looks low-tech, but we're still like really crafting every little angle of it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's stop there and let you ask another question. Cause,
Am I?
Sorry. I had to keep on, you know.
You're in the car?
I'm in the car, yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No.
I know you don't have a lot of time. You're going to...
No, it's noisy because I drive an old Mercedes that's running on vegetable oil, so you're hearing, like, the rumble of the diesel noise, but sorry.
Got it. What do you...
All right.
I guess, you know, sometimes in these conversations I get kind of, we get down to little points that are arcane, but I'm really curious, you know, what... about big questions, like what continues to inspire the two of you? Are you inspired, or do you just
oh,
like
no,
just
man,
a lot of labor?
It's all gone now. Well, one thing, you know, I think that one thing that continues on is, and what seems to be coming is sort of, you know, for example, I don't know, you probably haven't seen Altogether Now, which is another 25-minute piece that sort of jumps, it kind of almost in a weird way, like, finds Can't Swallow It, and it finds Masters of None, and it jumps into this sort of epic...
And it's the blue people.
Sociological zone that sort of borrows allegory and or you know, apocalypse, post-apocalyptic spaces as mm-hmm. a vehicle. And we've always been interested in experimenting with performativity and in relationship to video. So what is that, right? And then, especially with a hood on, what does performativity become? And without language, what does performativity become? And what is connection? What does a viewer connect with if there's no face? What can a body do without a face? What kind of ruthlessness is possible when something is faceless?
And
what
and
kind
I think
of
that, but
is
but there,
implied?
The facelessness, I mean, and even that conversation, like, while in Masters of None, yes, everybody's hooded. In Altogether mm-hmm. Now, actually, the central figure in the piece is not hooded at all. But what Harry's talking about, this conversation of, like, you know, what kind of effect or affect does a person have when their face is obscured, I think works metaphorically on a bigger level to what the piece is trying to address and what a lot of our work is trying to address, as in what type of efficacy does the citizen have with no actual power, or mm-hmm. what type of tools will be needed in order to communicate and, let's say, create community or at least cooperative situations when we finally accept that the powers, you know, the ruling power, power from above, actually doesn't work, and we want to go non-hierarchical in order to survive, let's say. Do you know what I mean? So, like, trying to project into that place where in the sort of, like, you know, celebrity-driven fascination,
right.
The fascination with, like, celebrity identity, for example, that seems to really sort of overwhelm pretty much everyone you talk to. You know what I mean? It's like is ingesting a tabloid hysteria of personality across the board. If we remove that from the conversation and you get back down to just people, mm-hmm. In some ways that's a different kind of facelessness that, you know, the hood can make it more obvious, like a gesture in the art making process, but I think that in a bigger picture, when we're having to look at the severe state of obviously the deterioration of the environment, but also, you know, international politics and all of these wars, like we're having to constantly, and we've always been doing this because we're both pretty much, you know, anarchists identified on some level in terms of our, you know, place as citizens and activists, and sort of constantly looking at, like, I'm not interested in the names the state gives me. I'm not interested in the avenues the state affords me to move in
right.
that restricts our movement as citizens and particularly restricts our ability to come together and create, you know, like, mutually respectful autonomous zones that are outside of that structure, blah, blah, blah. So if we're constantly mm-hmm. looking toward that as some kind of hopeful, and I don't mean utopian, but like really the last straw, what we
somehow
get
unofficiated,
to.
Though.
Well, yeah, of course, unofficiated, but I'm just saying, like, if that's like some type of visioning that we're constantly holding out for, then the question of cult of personality, the question of hierarchy and status then have to come into play, which is another way that things like hoods or masking or wearing matching outfits metaphorically
right.
in the artwork stands in for that kind of,
not that
people would be into, because that suddenly sounds really old school socialist in terms of like erasing individual identity, which is not what we mean at all. Hopefully it would be like
a
society.
But that's the question is, what is
everybody getting to be themselves? Okay, go ahead.
Well, exactly. How is that going to work when you're talking about the individual in community and what's there
right.
in a group, and what does one
yeah.
give up to be a part of a group, and what does one retain, so that there's questions for me that sort of surge into a more formal place, which is about specificity and the general too,
which
and
brings
sort of
back
like,
to yeah, and which brings back to division of labor, which will have to be addressed, of course, but in a more like willing and risk-taking manner, where in a community people are able to go, wow, so-and-so is really good at such and such a thing. So, yeah, y'all go do that. I'm good at this thing. I'll do that. I'm terrible at this, but I'd love to learn how to do it. Can someone teach me that? Like, those are the ways that community events ultimately have to operate, but everything in our current situation is pretty much, like, rerouting and sort of trying to stamp out at every path, right?
Well, what's your, okay. I mean, you okay, know, okay. This week is this huge political pageant with the Democratic convention. And, you know, today, tonight, Barack Obama is supposed to speak. And it was striking me because I'm just starting to read Dreams of My Father, or Dreams from My Father, anyway. And it's a, I don't know if you guys have read it.
No.
It's a surprisingly naked and personal book for a public, I mean, and he wrote it before he was a public figure. So, but I'm just curious, what do you guys make of, I mean, is there any kind of, you know, shift in the relationship between the person and the group that that any political candidate could represent?
I don't think, okay, this is just me personally, I don't think it's going to come from the Democrats or the Republicans.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I mean, I don't think that, maybe a Green Party situation. Like, I just don't think that the scale to which one must be in relationship to corporate interests if one is going
in order to be elected,
have the money to sustain that type of campaign and to be a player on that level. Sure I just sound like a naive fucking hippie at this point, but I mean, I swear to God, I just don't think that, I don't know how that can translate into a truly sort of grassroots trickle down situation. I'm not sure. You know, obviously, we'd just be back in that old conversation of like the lesser of evils. And it's true. I think Barack Obama is, you know, a different type of player than we've seen in that situation. But I think that it's also like, even if you look at someone like Martin Luther King, and I'm only making that comparison because of the historic moment that everyone's discussing right now, which is to have an African-American and someone who has sort of come up from a different social community than the traditionally white ruling class trajectory that most politicians come up through. Why I think Martin Luther King, let's say, probably never would have necessarily run for president or been in that situation, because his place was at the front lines in the grassroots. And that's why they killed him, right? You know what I mean? So, like, I don't know that you can step into that arena with a certain amount of sacrifice and compromise that would take you out of a more radical position. It just doesn't make sense. Like, I guess.
Yeah,
I just,
no, I understand that completely. I mean, I'm not surprised to hear you say that. But what do you do? Do you vote? How do you handle it?
Getting down to the nitty gritty here, Jen.
No, well, you know, I vote. I know, right? I'm like, God, we're just artists.
Sorry,
you know? But no, it's okay. We brought it up. We were like, man, our shit is revolutionary. Okay, so
picture and the future we can trust in.
You know, I voted for Cynthia McKinney in the primaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I refuse to. I was not able to bring myself to vote for
a Democrat.
Obama or Clinton, for sure. Clinton, Jesus Christ. You know what I mean? Like, anyways, not to go down that road, but really.
Not to go down that road, but the thing is, let's see what happens, you know? Hold on for a second. Three main issues, and I hope that if elected, you know, he deals with them, you know, like campaign finance reform is really going to, you know, help voter, you know, those voting machines that are owned by all Republicans and are digital, that's completely going to totally kill everything every time. No one's going to even believe their votes being counted. And the main thing seems to me is, how could it possibly be legal to be making laws and then quitting government and going to join an organization where you absolutely benefit from the laws, like Colin Powell's son, Michael Powell, being head of the FCC for how many years, totally deteriorating all of the monopoly laws therein, and then signing up, I believe, with Viacom and, you know, making millions of dollars a year. I mean, that's, and they're all doing that. How are they going to...
Yeah. I guess because I have to go in a minute, I want to just say one more thing, which is like that you said, you know, well, what do you do? Right. And I guess I'm going to just say personally, I'll vote. Sure, I'll vote. But it has to not stop there. I think that proactivity on the localized level is mm-hmm. crucial. And relying on the two-party system or relying on big government to make any kind of critical decisions that are really going to afford change towards the actual, like, life for people all around the world, like, you know, better standards of living? No, I don't think so. I think that it's going to always continue to have to come from the bottom up because...
Yes.
The people who are not feeling the pinch are not going to make the biggest move to make change. That's just not gonna how it's ever gonna be. So
it seems to me that one of the best things we can do is to begin just ourselves to live right lives. So if there's some vision for workability that you have, you know, then great. And to me, the people aren't gonna have any power if we're counting on corporations to give us food and water to buy. And unless we can make our own food and water, we're absolutely never going to be able to get out from under it. So for me, I've decided to teach myself and my community to make soil, make water, and make food. Because until we can do that, we're just infantilized by the system, and we're just going to need them.
And you're actually gardening right now, aren't you?
I'm gardening as we speak. And I have also a project called Pest Hole underway, which is a totally open source project, which has to do with helping people learn how to compost their own human waste and store it for a couple of years properly, composting, and then be able to have soil to be able to grow better food for themselves. And food and/or fruit trees. Mm-hmm. Test Hole is the collaboration name, and then the project is called Humble Pile. And regardless of what it's called, the point is that, you know, we're underway and we're just trying to get the word out. Because whenever I do try and grow food, Jen, it costs me $80 or $90 to buy soil.
Which is about what the food would
have cost. I mean, it's still good experience for me to see what would be entailed in trying to, you know, grow my own food. Should the grocery store someday be shut down? But, you know, I think that's what we need to do.
They are going to be shut down. It's all going downhill. I gotta go though.
All right. Jay,
thank you so much. You too.